Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
We have a very special guest on the Tennis Podcast for you today, somebody who topped the world rankings back in 2003-2004. He won a Grand Slam title. He will forever be remembered for the incredible Wimbledon final, the third one of his three that he had against Roger Federer in 2009. So coming up to the 10-year anniversary, it is Andy Roddick who's going to be joining us here on the Tennis Podcast. Absolutely delighted to have him with us. And if it's a show you think somebody else you know might be interested in listening to, do let them know. Here's Andy Roddick. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing, David?
Very well, very well. A couple of people I've spoken to recently have said, what does Andy Roddick do these days? So what does Andy Roddick do these days?
Everything and nothing, I guess. Not much in tennis, unfortunately. But a couple of young kids, a boy, Hank, who's 3.5, and a little girl, Stevie, who's 16 months, and a bunch of different business ventures, still running our foundation. In Austin, Texas, and trying to manage the logistics of life with a wife who's equally as busy. So it's all good. It's chaos most days, but great chaos.
You say not much in tennis, unfortunately. Do you mean that? I mean, would you like it to involve some tennis?
Yeah, it's not so much of the thing about tennis is that you have to travel to do it, right? You have to travel, whether it's any job. I mean, the jobs you have, you still have to go to the content, right? Or if you're a broadcaster, you have to be at the matches. Or if you're a coach, you have to be on site if you want to do your job well. And for me, I wouldn't want to take on a project in tennis unless I felt like I could give it the proper time commitment and respect that it deserved. And I can't do that right now. I'm not willing to. You know, one of the things when I retired is that I promised myself that I would never not control my geography in the projects that I was doing for, in a moderate way. I mean, obviously, I get away for a day or two at a time, but that was very important to me when I retired because I had essentially been on the road since I was, 12 or 13 years old. So that's something I really haven't compromised on, but I love the sport. I said everything I have in my life is because of the sport of tennis, whether it's relationships or business contacts or kind of a lane to talk about the foundation. It's all because of it. So I certainly kind of miss it, and we'll always have an immense love for it.
And you're still a young man. We've seen recently James Blake become Miami tournament director. We've seen Marty Fish become the new Davis Cup captain of the United States. I mean, there's still time, of course, for you to do, well, all sorts of things. Could you imagine when the kids are a little older and maybe the time commitments required for the other logistical elements of your life are different? Could you imagine wanting to come back into the sport in some way? And what do you think you would take your interest?
I just don't know because it's hard to kind of project forward, 10 years, kind of with everything going on and kind of different projects and different irons in the fire. I don't know what I know what my home life will look like in 10 years. I know what my life as a father will look like in 10 years. I know what my general geography will look like in 10 years as far as interests and what works and what doesn't, and kind of what will occupy the time, what will be more challenging. It's hard to kind of predict that, and you know, kind of life is a general response to those things. So you know, I think the intent to get back into it at some in some way, shape, or form will always be there, and you know, hopefully, kind of everything will come together, and that'll be possible down the road.
We've spent a lot of time over the last year and a half talking to and about Andy Murray, as of course all British journalists do anyway, but obviously interested in him because of his struggles with injury and his love for the game and his struggles to come to terms with the fact that his body's not letting him play it anymore. I just wonder whether what you replace it with, because I mean, you've described a lot of things that you do in life now, fantastic things, but how do you replace it? Because it's an incredible lifestyle, isn't it? And I suspect he's wrestled with that over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that would be a mistake is the expectation of being able to replace it. You know, I don't know that there's anything that will ever replace the, you know, the minute after a huge win on center court at Wimbledon, or, you know, the process of working for something for years and years and years and hundreds of hours of your life and then achieving it. You know, I don't know that exists anymore. I've talked to a number of different athletes and, you know, basketball players and football players, and some of them who are still active and they're curious what, you know, what's retirement like. And the best piece of advice I go, start planning for your life after your given sport while you're playing it. You know, I kind of dabbled in the radio space and the media space, and I was doing, you know, radio shows from Melbourne, Australia during the practice week before the Australian Open, kind of seeing if I liked it and if I wanted to pursue that. But to kind of get a gauge, I think the biggest mistake you can make would be to wake up, you know, retired and say, okay, now what do I do? Obviously the progression will change and you'll have to make decisions that'll come to you. But I think you always need to have a reason to kind of jump out of bed. And, you know, Andy certainly has a family that I didn't have, meaning children, when I retired. So obviously he's going to certainly have enough to do, in that space, but he's super, super smart, super analytical. So he's certainly not one of the ones that I worry about. I think there's going to be a sadness and some kind of time getting used to it. And when something's taken away that you've been doing from, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, there's certainly a period of mourning, but he's certainly not someone that I worry about long term.
No, I think we probably felt similarly about you really back in the day. And I think probably even you felt that, didn't you, about your own career? I don't think you were particularly worried when you stopped, even though there's some sadness.
No, I don't know that I was worried. I mean, I think you always feel a little bit of melancholy about it. You know, it's this new beginning and it's exciting. You don't have kind of the day-to-day stresses or pressures or expectations or, you know, you don't have to share your life as much. And for me, those were all positives. But then, you know, I wouldn't, it's weird. When I turned on a tournament, if it was kind of a tournament in the city that, you know, I've been to a couple times, or if it wasn't something like a Wimbledon or US Open, I really wouldn't kind of get that thing where I missed it too much. But when I like passed an empty track at like 7 in the morning, you know, where I used to put in the hours, and that's kind of where I felt like I would win. I always joke that I would win 30 matches during the off season, you know, per year. So it was weird. I missed that part of it. I was a little backwards, but, you know, I was always very confident in what I was going home to. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, for a lot of people, they're not only leaving the tour, but they're leaving their social life. You know, a lot of people's kind of primary social existence is on tour. So that's also a hard thing that I don't think gets talked about enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you're sort of loosely referencing almost the mental health of athletes. And it's such a talking point in life generally. I spent an hour on the phone this afternoon with Janka Tipsarevic, who was describing 7 surgeries that he went through over the last 5 years, and he's now back on the circuit, and the sort of struggles that he had to try to, you know, deal with the fact that he wasn't what he used to be and that he was still trying to be. Can you, I mean, you you always came across, certainly on the circuit, as somebody who didn't sit around for long. You went from A to B and cracked on, and if that didn't work, you pushed on to the next goal or the next obstacle. But is it challenging mentally on the circuit?
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I think it's twofold, though, because you answer this and it can get taken two ways, right? You know, a professional athlete who can play tennis for a living and make a great living, you know, acknowledging anything that might be hard is sometimes taken, you know, not well. So I'll enter into this with respect to that point of view. But certainly when you're kind of putting in, you know, months and years of time, getting back to where the upside of all that effort might be your shadow of your best self. Yeah, I mean, that's hard, isn't it? Right? I mean, and that's not something that most people in another industry, you know, David, your best story or your best interview might be ahead of you, and you'll always have that. When an athlete gets kind of behind the injury, you know, I guess on the wrong side of the injury, it's hard for them to think that. We might fool ourselves, or we might live in kind of the sense of denial for a little bit. But I can certainly relate to what, or I don't know about relate, but understand what Yanko is talking about, and certainly empathize with it.
It's a pretty big anniversary tennis-wise for you, maybe for not the happiest reason, because it's 10 years since your match with Roger in the final of Wimbledon, and although you didn't win it, it's for many people one of the ones they remember the most that you were involved with. I just wonder, looking back at that and looking back at your career, and now you've got young kids, what do you think, when they're old enough, if they show an interest in your career, what do you think you might like to tell them about it? What do you think you might like to show them?
I don't know that I would really volunteer anything. You know, I don't really think backwards too much. You know, obviously, you know, you see people and they talk about it, and whatever I do and whatever successes I may or may not have in other parts of my life, I'll always be kind of associated with tennis, and, you know, certainly with that match as well. You know, I guess one of the things I always took pride in was kind of being able to, you know, I lost way more than I won. You don't win every tournament you enter. You know, I won 32 of them out of I don't know how many, and that, you know, puts you in pretty good standing. You leave most weeks disappointed with something, right? It's rarely you leave and it's like, okay, I won the week. You know, so I always took a little bit of pride in kind of getting up off the mat. You know, tough losses is a tough loss, and you chew on it. It can it could affect me emotionally. I could be upset about it. I could be sad about it, but I could also get on with it and get my work in. You know, so for that month after Wimbledon, and, you know, you don't know if you're, you know, similar to what we talked about with Yanko, I didn't know if I was going to get back to that stage, and I ended up not getting back to that stage. But it's certainly a little bit of heartbreaking. But I always kind of found a certain amount of therapy and getting the work back in, right? Getting on the track, sweating, you know, kind of getting it out, taking out maybe some anger, training. For me, that the kind of training mechanism always felt like home, always helped. And I took a lot of pride in being able to kind of take my knocks, take my shots, take my punches, and kind of pull myself up and kind of get on with it.
Yeah, I was listening back to an interview you did with us about 5 years ago when we were at the Royal Albert Hall, and you were talking us through the aftermath of that match, etc. So there's no need to go through the old ground of that. But I'm curious about the fact that the rules this year have changed, so that your match ended 16-14. And I just wonder, if you'd have been offered a tiebreak at 12-all back then, do you think you would have taken it?
I honestly don't know, David. My normally against most people I'd say yes, but my tiebreaker record, you know, throughout my career against Roger was pretty bad. I think I haven't seen the numbers. I don't know what the numbers are. It just feels like it was kind of bad. So, and at that point I hadn't been broken all day, and I felt like I was actually getting into Roger's service games on return pretty regularly. The other thing, the conditions, like the shadow kind of creeping across throughout the afternoon, ended up kind of being tough for me to deal with, but it could have been just as easily been tough for him to deal with. So kind of bringing in those outliers, which are a bit of an equalizer sometimes, those are all things I probably would have thought about. And, you know, retrospect is easy, but in the moment, I honestly don't know. I think most people would assume I would say, obviously, yes, I would have taken the tiebreaker, but I actually don't know if I would have.
Mm. Yeah. And I think I'm right saying you served second throughout that fifth set, didn't you?
Yeah, because I got broken the words, yep.
Do you feel that, generally speaking, is a big difference in a match? I mean, I don't know about that one specifically, but I mean, if you are serving second, do you feel there is more pressure on you?
Well, I think the tougher part would have been, had I broken, you know, that just not being the match, right? But actually going through the process of breaking serve and then kind of having to serve it out for Wimbledon, that's a hard thing to do. You know, so I think people try to give me that excuse for that fifth set. And yeah, sure, it's hard, but sports is hard. You know, if you want to be Wimbledon champion, you're going to have to do something that's not comfortable. It's honestly not something I think about as like, I look back at that match and it's not like, well, if I had a serve first in that fifth set, it would have been mine for sure. I don't know that. And it's honestly not, in my mind, it's not as big of a deal as people try to make it.
Which of the final set situations at Slams that we now have, because all four of them are different. I think it's standard tiebreak at the US Open at 6-6. It's first to 10 at 6-6 at the Australian Open. It's 12-12 standard tiebreak at Wimbledon, and it's played out at the French Open. Which one do you like?
I don't know that they all have to be the same. And, you know, I like kind of the – I think the – fifth set kind of early shootout in New York fits the tournament, right? Yeah, I don't mind it. I think the other thing we need to talk about it at Wimbledon is, you know, the you can only play for so long at night, so you do need a cap. You know, the whole time I kind of have a little bit of a different take on it than a lot of people, but you know, last year I'm watching Anderson Isner, and you know, certainly the drama is there. You're wondering who's going to give out physically and who can hold, and you know. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, as much of a draw of a semifinal as those two guys are, I'm guessing, you know, they don't let kind of the undercard at a rock concert play five times longer than the main band. And Nadal and Djokovic were still supposed to play that day. That gets bumped to the next day. And then you're stuck with the problem of, do we put it before the women's final? Do we put it after the women's final? What's appropriate? What pays the appropriate amount of respect to the women's match. So for me, my mind went to like programming, business, sponsors. Are we doing everyone in the kind of circle and orbit of tennis justice? And I think maybe no would have been my answer as far as kind of the business metrics of tennis. And I think when it becomes a little bit more predictable and at least people can kind of schedule their day around seeing the matches they want to see, I think that's going to be probably beneficial to tennis in the long run. But yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm a fan. I want to, the matches we remember are the ones that go forever and, you know, have the high drama, and that's amazing. But, you know, we also used to watch VHS tapes. You know, I'm just never a fan of doing something a certain way because just that's the way it's always been done. I think we constantly need to innovate and adjust to our market and our viewers.
Yeah, I must admit, the first time I ever went to the Australian Open was when you beat Yunus Helenawi 21-19 in the fifth set. And if somebody had told me then that I would ever think that a final set tiebreak was a good idea, I would have thought they were mad. But I would go for it now, I must say.
Yeah, and there's no right answer. It's people kind of in everyday life. In culture, we kind of deal in absolutes, and it's either you're right or you're wrong. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. It's just, you know, what's most beneficial for the game is how I would approach it.
Mm. With that in mind, do you think you would change anything else about tennis, generally speaking, the scoring system, for instance? Would you go to best of three from best of five ever at Slams?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we should never do it. You know, my argument for best of three would be, you know, we don't have a home team. You know, we're not the New York Yankees where we can count on people coming regardless just because they like our team. you know, I think if anything has been proven in the last 5 years is that when our icons of the sport play longer, whether it's Rafa, whether it's Roger, whether it's Serena, Venus, the game is better for it, right? And so, you know, if I'm not saying I'm on that level, but just as an individual, like, kind of decision to be made, if I'm required to play, you know, and by rules of the game at the time, I think it was, I was required to play 18 events, you know, probably expected to play Davis Cup, you know, 3 out of 5 at kind of Davis Cup, all the slams. And I'm going, that's a tall order. And that probably affected, you know, whether or not I thought I could get through it physically. Now, if you give me best of 3 sets, I probably still feel like at a slam, I can catch lightning in a bottle and make a run to a semi or a final. Therefore, you know, kind of keeping maybe a name in the game longer. And I think there's probably a trickle down effect from that. How much longer would Roger be able to play if it was 3 sets? I mean, I think that's a discussion that should be had. Because I do think it's important to keep our individual stars in the game as long as possible.
Mm. One of those individual stars, Novak Djokovic, you mentioned him at Wimbledon. Extraordinary to think that he went on, he won that incredible match against Nadal, and he's won the last 3 slams. Here he is on 15, you've got Nadal on 17, you've got Federer on 20. Do you feel now that they are within reach? I mean, Federer's total?
Oh yeah, I think so. I would be surprised if someone said no, that's out of reach for those guys. I mean, you have to, as long as Rafa's healthy. I mean, he seems to be healthy for the clay court season every year. So as long as he's healthy, you have to make him the favorite there, right? I mean, there's every chance he has 18, and if he can sneak in another one, I mean, you know, so certainly. And for Novak, it's just a matter of, you know, mentally, can he get up for it? Can he avoid kind of that lull that he had? Seemingly from a mental perspective, for those couple of years, and, you know, can he maintain? You know, that's one of the most impressive things about Roger, is his ability to maintain competitiveness, will, the ability to be away from home for his entire life. When he's got a pretty good gig, the day that he decides he doesn't want to play anymore. Yeah, but they're certainly within reach. It wouldn't surprise me if any of those three kind of had the lead when it was all said and done.
Wow. It's pretty extraordinary to think, isn't it, that, I mean, you shared a career with them, with three of the all-time greats at the same time, doing it together. I mean, it is mind-boggling, really, isn't it?
Well, the crazy thing is, in the conversation I kind of have just, you know, whenever I'm talking about tennis, is, you know, they're like, oh, Roger, Rafa, and they kind of don't talk about Novak as much, or whoever I'm talking to. I say, you know, the names that you'll kind of be in awe of, if I say Agassi, they're like, oh yeah, he's one of the best ever. You know, or I say Connors, and they go, oh yeah. Or I say McEnroe, and they go, oh yeah. I go, okay, you know, Andre had, those guys had 7 slams, 8 slams, and 8 slams. Novak has 15. So let's just give the proper context to what he's done. And the only reason he's not the best of all time is because of these other giants that have been playing at the exact same time. I go, you need to tune in and you need to enjoy what's in front of you.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I remember years ago when you were doing your podcast with my favorite person in the world, Bill Reiter, and you had a discussion about who's the greatest out of Jordan and LeBron James. I think it was on that mm-hmm. show. In your mind, if Djokovic, say, for instance, got to 21 or 22 and finished ahead of them, would you have any hesitation in anointing him as the greatest of all time based on that?
No, I mean, he's won. I mean, it would come down to, you know, the only way you couldn't is if he hadn't won the career Grand Slam. His head-to-head record is, he has a winning record against both of them. You know, he's certainly done the work in Master Series events also, you know. You know, that would be, if you were making an argument against Pete, you know, it'd be like, okay, well, these guys won 30-something Masters Series titles, and I think Pete won 12. That's not saying that Pete's not amazing. It's just saying these guys are amazing all the time in every tournament, and that's a level of, you know, consistency, focus, and excellence, you know, yada, yada, yada. But I don't know past just I like the other person more how you would not call Novak the greatest all time if he finished with the most slams.
Mm. That's fair. And meanwhile, Serena's trying to do the same. I mean, I think in many people's eyes, but now that she has gone ahead of Steffi Graf, they feel that is the most relevant record that she's on 23 slams. Officially, she's one behind Margaret Court, who's on 24, different era, of course. It's getting harder for Serena Williams. Obviously, she's been through a heck of a lot with the complications she had in childbirth, but she still reached two slam finals last year. What do you feel? Do you think she will manage to get a couple more?
I think she will, just because I know how damn stubborn she is. I know that she wants it, and I know, she's not used to not getting her way. And she normally kind of exhausts, every possible thing to make sure that happens. Now, it doesn't get easier. I don't think it's as easy as it's been for the last 20 years, where the conversation is, if Serena plays great, she's going to win. She almost died during childbirth. I mean, it was a serious, serious, serious issue to even come back from that. And I think, she senses she's so close, and, it's not easy. The beauty about sports is nothing's given. There's no script. History doesn't care if you're Serena Williams. You still have to go out and win seven matches. You can't, you don't win six and then they just give it to you. That's the beauty of sports. It's hard every day. And, I think she'll get there, but there's a certain beauty in the fact that it didn't just happen right away. It shows her grittiness. It shows how she wants to get back, and but she'll get there. Obviously, she needs to be looking at the French will be tough. If I'm her, I have Wimbledon circled. I mean, she came back there and almost won it last year with pretty much zero reps and zero match play, zero confidence, and still almost pulled the rabbit out of the hat.
And she almost pulled the rabbit out of the hat at the US Open, ran into Naomi Osaka. Obviously, things kicked off pretty spectacularly during that final. And you, I seem to remember, were initially, certainly immediately, on her side, critical of the officiating. Did you change your view after that?
Yeah, a little bit. I was in the stadium, so I didn't have the benefit of kind of TV coverage and everything else. And kind of the more I thought about it, I think the official probably was a little embarrassed. I think there was maybe some ego. I think it probably could have been handled a little bit differently. And I don't think anyone was right. And I think everybody was wrong. The criticism that I would have of Serena, and she's a dear friend of mine, and if she was on this call, I wouldn't change what I had to say. I was pretty crazy on the court, and I said, I've done worse. But I don't think I've done worse when I've already had a point penalty. Right. So I think situational emotional management, matters. I would do a lot of things when I had a warning or if I had no warning to get a warning that were terrible. But I think I was aware enough to where if I had a point penalty, especially in a match like that, that I wouldn't do anything that would leave it up to the umpire's discretion. Do I think the umpire, went too far? Well, yeah, it's my personal opinion that he did. I think he probably should have chilled out. She didn't cuss. She was, she was going at him hard, and she certainly said some things that he might not have agreed with. But, I don't know that it was unsportsmanlike conduct as it's written. There was nothing broken. There was nothing. It had already been broken, but not, each instance is supposed to kind of be, you start with a clean slate, right? So, I think she was wrong just for realizing, she shouldn't even allow him to be able to make an overstep when she's there with a point penalty that would lead to a game penalty.
You mentioned that she is, that how stubborn she is. She has never spoken to us really about the situation afterwards, other than what she did at the immediate time. She's never told us that she thinks, in hindsight, maybe I got it wrong. Do you think she might feel differently about it now?
I don't know. I honestly haven't talked to her about the incident. We kind of see each other here and there now. But, I also feel like she's probably still getting through it herself. It's a weird thing to kind of feel emotional. And as athletes, we're defiant when we leave the court. I certainly said things and believed them. And then in retrospect, time, allows us to think a little clearer. But, she doesn't need to sit down with anyone. She doesn't need to go through it. Her focus is elsewhere. She doesn't need to focus on you know, regurgitating, you know, last September if she wants to, and she finds it therapeutic and she feels like she should get something out there or she wants to get something out there, then that's certainly her call. But I don't think we're owed anything. She certainly has given us enough great moments, and we like her because, and we love her and respect her because of what she does on the court. So I'm sure in time she'll talk about it, but she certainly doesn't have to. And maybe her focus is forward, not looking backwards. But you know, she'll probably get to it eventually.
Mm. You mentioned she's a dear friend of yours, and obviously you've known each other a long time. Who is the Serena you know?
It's a Serena that I wish everyone would know. It's someone who will come over and kind of hang out in your kitchen and laugh and joke, and there's no walls up kind of around her. Easygoing, great sense of humor, talks about all the normal stuff that everyone else would talk about. She feels comfortable, and I wish kind of more people got to see that side of her. But I certainly respect, and especially as kind of media has gone this way, everyone wants everyone to share everything. And then once they do, there's immediate backlash. There's social reaction. It blows up into, you know, whatever. So, you know, I can understand that people don't even want to kind of go and bring that into their lives.
Yeah, I think I can probably too.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. There's a lot going on in the sports off the court at the moment, Andy. I don't know how closely you've followed it, but the ATP CEO, Chris Kermode, is going to be leaving at the end of the year. He's had six years, I think. What's your take on it all? I remember during your career, you were at the forefront of arguing for a greater percentage of the pie for players from what certainly the biggest most successful tournaments were making. That's something Janko Tipsarevic was speaking strongly about to me earlier. What is your take of the job that Chris did from your vantage point and the decision not to renew his contract?
So I don't know a lot of the particulars. I try not to be one of those guys who is uninformed and an expert at the same time, if that makes sense. I don't know the inner workings. I have talked to zero people about the politics of it. I'm not too concerned with it. One thing I have felt for a long time, and I am on record as saying, is that I do think players need separate representation from tournaments. I don't think you can negotiate in good faith and for the best interest of everybody on the same side of the table. I just don't think, you know, no other business runs that way. You know, it just doesn't really work. You know, and I think the powers that be have been kind of betting on division, whether it's, you know, clay court schedule versus hard court schedule versus doubles cutoff versus, you know, who knows what. And kind of all these, they're not little decisions in the moment, but I think there are bigger decisions that would deserve focus from a player's perspective. And I think we get caught up in the minutia of kind of the smaller individual self-serving decision. You know, so every kind of big global sport seemingly has a players union where there's an independent voice, where it's not as if we're against anyone. It's just, hey, we want our own separate voice. And when we come to the table, there needs to be some, you know, dialogue with respect, and there doesn't need to be a tie-breaking vote with someone who's supposed to be representing both sides. That just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I suppose the challenge is who's going to step up and actually be prepared to do something about it. Because one of the things Janka was saying, that with Novak being the president of the player council, it's pretty exhausting trying to combine being the greatest of all time eventually and at the same time trying to run the good of the sport in a political stage.
Yeah, and it's tough, because the other thing that I think the tournaments and tours and Davis Cup and you know, kind of all the people, the slams, I think they realize the only huge PowerPoint that the players can leverage to really get attention is participation, which puts the players in a really bad spot. And it would be a PR nightmare if they chose to exercise that. I do think that they would probably get a lot of what they wanted if they decided to use something like that. Maybe they throw an exhibition for charity somewhere in the vicinity of whatever you know, tournament they weren't playing. But you know, it is something that would be exercised in a different business if it was a point of leverage. It's just, when there's love of the game and the players don't want to alienate fans, and I think that's the onus has kind of been put on them for a long time, and they certainly haven't exercised that option. But you know, that's certainly you know, it would be ugly, but in the long run, it'd be better for the players ranked 60, 70, 80, 90, you know, maybe someone 200 in the world could actually make a living playing tennis. So you know, I don't know. There's no comfortable conversation if you actually want big results.
Couple of final points. You played a lot of Davis Cup in your time. You were part of a winning team. You always had your hand up for it. What do you think of the proposal or the new version of the Davis Cup that we're going to be getting this year at the end of the year in Madrid?
I hope they find a better week eventually. I think it's hard to tack on 10 days of, you know, super intense competition that, you know, is supposed to mean as much as a slam when you're kind of running on fumes. I think that would be hard. I do think change is necessary. I hate that it took an event like Laver Cup, you know, to where they were getting the big names and Davis Cup names, and to kind of, I feel like the ball was in Davis Cup's court to make change, make adjustments, make it a biannual event, make it, you know, there were a lot of options. And I think they waited till the last possible scenario until someone else kind of forced their hand. To me, that was irresponsible. I think it was, hopefully it's not too little too late. I felt like they had to make a change, because it's just only so much tennis that can be put on a body and traveling. Especially like my most nervous matches and my most exhausting matches, a lot of time were in Davis Cup. Like it's a huge toll and responsibility. So I hope it goes great. But it, to me, on the outside, it's just been frustrating to watch it kind of. It's been a very passive process. Basically, we're fine. We're Davis Cup. We're fine. We're Davis Cup. When they could have been very proactive without any competition for a very long time.
Fingers crossed. Final one, Andy. You've presented your own podcast. You're talking on a podcast. Do you listen to podcasts?
I do listen to podcasts.
What do you listen to?
I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to Gladwell's Revisionist History. I listen to Guy Raz, How I Built This. I listen to a lot of NPR. I listen to a podcast called Planet Money. And I'll kind of check in with, you know, kind of some various local podcasts sometimes also.
And how's your golf? Because Tim Henman became the world's greatest retired tennis player golfer pretty much when he retired. How's yours?
Tim needs to check in with Fish.
Oh, right.
Fish is disgustingly good. I'm not quite as good, but I'm good enough at golf to know that I'm not very good.
And you've got some sort of golf initiative going on at the moment. I saw a picture on social media. What's this course that you're involved in?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that nothing. So it's a little project, but it's a little course in outside of Chattanooga in Tennessee. It's a cool story. It's called Sweetens Cove, and basically this guy Rob Collins is a really kind of artistic golf mind architect. He would kind of he found this basically dying municipal course in Tennessee and kind of rented equipment, built this golf course, shaped the land by himself. He was also the head pro. He would shag balls. He was the attendant. He would drive something out. He basically wore 14 hats for this little golf course that he created. Since then, it's gotten, you know, a lot of love, where it's one of the top 50 courses in the country, and it's only 9 holes, and he's created this kind of amazing thing. And you basically check in as this little shed trailer thing. There's no real plumbing, so you know, whatever. You can do the math on that weirdness. But we just feel like it's a really cool story. We feel like there's probably some branding to be done down the road. We have a kind of a strong leadership group. And we have some ideas that will kind of be announced in time. But basically, we just want to create a sustainable model. It's a great place for a father to be able to take his son for a low price point and play one of the best golf courses in the country. But that model has been challenging. We want to make sure that it's always in place, but that requires creating ancillary revenue. So we're certainly walking through that walking through that strategy, and we'll kind of have something down the road.
It's all great, Andy. The only thing is, I think I listen to this and I do think, crikey, this feels like such a waste for tennis that you are not involved in it in some way. I think it's great that you have all these other interests, but at some point, I would hope that you would be able to find something in tennis to direct your energy and your brain power into.
Yeah, I would too. There's a lot of politics in tennis. There's a lot of things that kind of make it hard. We'll kind of see how all of this shakes out and where tennis is at in a couple of years. But I certainly love it. I love watching it. I still love going out and hitting balls. I love the innocent parts of tennis, and I even miss you sometimes, David.
No.
You're right. Not at all.
Let's end on a truthful note. No, seriously, lovely to have you with us on the podcast, Andy. I hope the best for you and for your family. I hope you keep well and hope to see you soon.
All right. Thanks, David. I appreciate it a lot.
So there's Andy Roddick here on the Tennis Podcast. Really thrilled that he was able to join us and give us so much of his time. He is somebody that I remember coming on the circuit when I was working at the ATP Tour as a communications manager, going back into the early 2000s. I remember seeing him play for the first time in Miami, I think in about 2001. And to be honest, for the first few years, I didn't get on particularly well with him. I found him difficult to get along with. I didn't really understand where he was coming from. He was incredibly energetic. He was incredibly fiery. He was incredibly funny as well. I mean, a good laugh to be around. But as the years went on, I started to get him and understand that, as well as the fun you could have with him in press conferences, and I have to say, he could make you feel and look stupid sometimes. If you asked a stupid question, my goodness, he didn't just paper over that. He would let you have it. He would let you know about it, and it was uncomfortable at times. But I don't mind that. That's a challenge. And as I encountered him more, I realised what a decent guy he is, how loyal he is. That's always something that always struck me about Andy Roddick. He seems such a loyal person, and the the chap who arranged this interview for me is somebody who's part of his team now and is the son of a London taxi driver that Andy Roddick met well over 10 years ago and befriended, and now is a firm friend of the entire family, sees them, speaks to them all the time, and just that kind of guy. He's a really family-oriented type of fellow. He's given me a couple of interviews now, and I always enjoy his company, and hope you enjoyed listening to him as well. You can hear there just how much he has to offer this sport and anything he throws himself into. And, yeah, let's hope that Andy Roddick is going to become a big part of tennis once more. I'm sure he will in the future. I'm fascinated to see what it is going to be. If you've enjoyed this show, we hope to bring similar types of interviews for you again in the future. This has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by TennisBalls.com with our mascot, Rio with a Y. And do tell your friends about this show. Let them know that it's worth listening to if you've enjoyed it. And we'll see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.